Welcome to 3GT, the podcast for three guys, a pastor, a professor, and a parishioner discuss theology from a practical standpoint, all from a Reformed perspective. Find out more at 3GT.xyz.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of 3GT. That's Three Guys Theologizing. And those three guys are Scott Hunt and Kyle Borg, and this is Barry York. We're glad that you've joined with us. And we do have a special guest appearing again. Very rarely do we have a guest on again, much less the very next episode. But if you tuned into the last episode of 3GT, you know that we interviewed Jennifer Michelle Greenberg, who is the author of Not Forsaken, where she chronicles the abuse that she suffered as a child. And we explored with Jennifer the personal lessons that she learned through that experience, the trauma that she went through, some of the theology that she has really rested in to overcome that. We heard about her home life. And so we really appreciated that. But one of the things that we wanted to explore further with Jennifer is how abuse is treated in the church, some of her experience regarding that, some of the things that she's currently doing in order to help the church. As a professor of pastoral theology and one who regularly instructs young men about how to shepherd God's people, I have found this is one of the issues that the church is woefully lacking in. Often abusive situations are covered up. They're not addressed for various reasons. And so we need to shine a greater light in that. And I think Jennifer is a great person to help us to do that. So Jennifer, thank you for joining us for this second episode. We're glad that you were willing to do this with us.
Yes,
thank you. I'm honored. Thank you so much.
One of the things that you mentioned in the previous episode is how it took you up to 10 years before you felt like you could finally open up about all that had happened to you as a child, as you were abused by your father. And yeah. I thought we would start there. Sometimes it's hard for people who haven't gone through that experience or been close to abusive situations to understand how someone could go on for so long suffering this abuse without saying something. So sure. You need to help us and our listeners and others to, from your perspective as an abuse victim and survivor, why is that, and what can we do as the church to help in this type of situation?
Absolutely, yeah. It's I will tell you, it is extremely complicated. There's obviously, you know, the issue of fear. You know, there's a big fear, especially when I was a child and a teenager, that, you know, if I were to tell our pastor, my dad would find out. And he would retaliate, and I would suffer greatly, and I'd still, you know, be trapped in that dysfunctional home. So there was a big fear, and unfortunately, that's a practical fear, because, you know, at one point I did try to tell several pastors, actually, and one pastor just did nothing about it. And so, you know, I ended up just, like, my worst fear, just going back home and then just hoping that the pastor didn't tell my dad what I had said.
What age were you at that time?
I was 15 or 16 years old. Mm-hmm. And, the youngest, and it's funny because I just recently kind of put this together. The youngest I ever tried to report, I was about 5 years old. And we were on a trip to visit with some friends, and I remember that my parents had told me that the father in this family was some kind of a doctor, and so I thought that I would talk to him And, you know, I didn't have the vocabulary, you know, to say abuse or domestic violence or even in sex. You know, I didn't have those words in my vocabulary yet. And so I told this guy, don't you think it's weird that people make babies the same way dogs do? And what I was hoping, even at that young age, was that he would say, wait a minute, you know, what are you talking about? You know, how do you know this? What have you seen? Did somebody say something? You know, ask me questions. But instead he said, be quiet. We don't talk about those things. Mm. And when I tried to bring it up again, he snapped at me and told me we're done with this conversation. And so that really kind of cemented in my mind from a young age that I would not be believed. Mm. And so in addition to the fear of not being believed, there's also the fear that if you are believed, you know, maybe someone will tell your dad, maybe the police will come and take you out of your home. I mean, it's just a scary situation. But I think one of the things that a lot of people don't understand is that a large thing that motivates silence is love. You know, you love your dad. You love your family member, this person in your life who you trust, who you're supposed to be able to trust, you love them. Mm-hmm. And you also love, you know, I also love my mom and I love my little sisters. And as far as I was aware, my younger sisters were not being abused. They had happy childhoods, and or at least that's what I thought at the time. And so I was afraid that if I told anybody about what my dad was doing, that I would be destroying their childhoods. And so I stayed quiet for a very long time because I felt that that was the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. I think too, and just talking with others, I know sometimes there's also things such as false hope that it's going to get better. You just always keep wishing
Absolutely.
It gets better. Scott, you work in this Yeah. field in one sense where you're a prosecuting attorney and often have to try domestic abuse cases, or I'm sure this is striking a chord with you and the things that you typically hear.
It really is. Oftentimes, particularly in sexual abuse cases, the allegations don't come out until much, much later. And so from a legal standpoint, it is one of the difficulties that we have, which is why, Jennifer, I really appreciate you saying this. We have to explain why it took so long for the victim to say something. You see it a lot also in domestic violence cases between husband and wife where the wife won't say anything. And I see this, and we'll talk to them and they say, but I love him. And he said he won't do this again.
Yeah.
So there, and I have seen this in my profession a lot where these women who come in bloody and battered, they say, I love him and he won't do it again. Please let him come home. I can't take care of the family on my own. So I think there is, what I understand, Jennifer, is there's a lot of control issues too from the abusers. And did you see that from your father, that it was as much about control over you as anything else? Or?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was, you know, I think he enjoyed inflicting fear. I think that a lot of the mind games that he played were aimed to make me feel insecure, to doubt my own sanity, to doubt my feelings, to second guess myself. And of course, the reason why an abuser would want their victim to be very insecure and unsure of themselves would be because that way the victim would be less likely to report. It's very simple, and it's frighteningly logical.
You also mentioned that, you know, I believe it was the doctor that you were talking to said, we're not going to talk about this again.
Yeah.
Was that something that you found that people just didn't want to deal with this kind of abuse and wanted to keep their heads buried in the sand?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I actually, when I was in my early 20s, during my early marriage, I was really desperate for friends. And I started going to this ladies' Bible study at our church. And one evening I got there early and it was just a couple of women, one of them being the teacher. And I brought it up that I, you know, I'd been abused. And she said, you know, we don't talk about those things here, that this is what we have pastors for. And, you know, at the time, I mean, I was a newlywed. I was a young woman. I didn't want to talk to a pastor about sexual abuse was the last thing I wanted to do. And so that was really hurtful. But I, you know, it's funny. I've gotten that same excuse even from doctors. Like when I visited my OBGYN, the first time I went for an OBGYN appointment, I was concerned that I might have a panic attack. And I said, you know, I was molested as a child. And if I start to have a panic attack, I want you to understand why. And she's like, it's okay. We don't deal with those things here. And she just, yeah, and they just kind of smiled at me and went on with things. And it was the strangest experience. But yeah, so it was very, even when I did try to tell, it was very minimized, swept under the rug, so to speak. You know, or simply just disbelieved. A lot of people just don't believe you.
Mm-hmm. When you went to, you mentioned, I think in our former podcast episode, that you went to the church and tried to get some help there. When you didn't receive that, what was their, how did they respond to you? Was it they didn't believe you, or some of this, we don't deal with that here, or your dad's a good man? What was it that they were saying to you that kept them from helping you in a time of need?
Sure. You know, some of it was good. You know, there was a lot of, there were a lot of loving people who had very good intentions, but I think, you know, dealing with someone with that level of trauma and PTSD, they were frankly in over their heads. And I remember, you know, so unfortunately, you know, this is kind of the way that memory works, right? We tend to remember the bad experiences in a lot more detail than the good experiences. Mm-hmm. And I remember being told that, you know, you really need to just forgive your dad. You need to stop being angry and you need to forgive him. You know, God commands you to forgive him. One person even told me that, you know, if you don't forgive your dad, God won't forgive you. Hmm. And so, you know, that really just turned forgiveness into legalism. It became a works mentality, and it was crushing for a long time. I would get so riddled with anxiety before going to church that a couple times I threw up just while I was getting ready to go to church. And a couple times I tried to make myself throw up on purpose, you know, in hopes that my husband would, you know, say, hey, you know, we need to stay home. And then I wouldn't have to explain to him the real reason why I didn't want to go. So, you know, that was really hard. And I think that at one point I had a full blown panic attack at church. And, I mean, I was crying and I hyperventilated, and one of the elders, you know, ran and got Jason. And at that point they finally recommended, you know, Jennifer, you need to go see a therapist. But there was really no help in finding a therapist. You know, it's just basically find someone who's Christian and who's dealt with abuse before. That was like their recommendation. And I did. I found this sweet little old lady who was a Catholic, and she actually fell asleep during several of our therapy sessions. But which, you know, it was funny. It's like at first it was like she started snoring, and I was like, at first I was offended. But then I was like, wait, this is great. I can just tell this person anything and she won't even remember. So I just, you know, I was able to kind of pour my heart out to her. And, you know, I told her about some of the things that were going on at church and how I was being pressured to forgive and how I felt like I was not understood. And, you know, she recommended that we, you know, find a new church, which eventually we did. And it turned out to be a very good thing at the time. So, yeah.
That's good. Jennifer, let's say for a moment that Kyle and Scott and I are pastors and elders all together in the same church. Mm-hmm. And we've had a younger you come to us. what would you counsel us to do if a 15-year-old girl came to us and shared some of the things that had happened to you, to us? What should we do?
Involve law enforcement immediately.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And that was going to be my question. Did anybody ever counsel you, you need to call law enforcement?
No, in fact, I was dissuaded from doing that. I was encouraged to kind of forgive and forget. I had one pastor told me, who was also a lawyer, actually.
Sorry.
But unfortunately, I realized that he was also friends with my dad, and I didn't understand that at that point. But anyway, he was a pastor and a lawyer, and he actually lied and said that the statute of limitations was up. And he told me that there was no point in reporting what my dad had done, because he said that unless my dad had punched me with a closed fist, that anything he did was legal, which of course is a horrible lie. Mm-hmm. And but because I trusted him as a pastor and as a lawyer, I believed him. And you know, that season when you're kind of at what I call the ground zero phase of your recovery process, that's when, you know, you're suddenly realizing that actual crimes have been committed. PTSD is manifesting hard. You've got panic attacks, you've got recurring nightmares. It's just, you know, depression, anxiety, the works. It's mm-hmm. awful. It's one of the most awful things I've ever been through. And so you're very vulnerable, and you're very willing to trust anyone. And if someone kind of poo-poos what you've been through, or, you know, says forgive and forget, you trust them. Mm-hmm. And so you don't get help. And I think it's really important, particularly because, well, besides the fact that it's just morally, it's the right and ethically responsible thing to do. I think a lot of pastors don't realize that in many states, if not most states, they're actually mandatory reporters. And they can actually be prosecuted if they do not immediately inform law enforcement. And, you know, that could be calling the police non-emergency number. Mm-hmm. That could mean contacting CPS. That could mean, you know, any number of things. Or just calling, you know, some law enforcement agency, just asking, what should I do? Mm-hmm. You know, just doing something to kind of get the ball rolling and making sure that this survivor or this victim is protected. One thing that I've learned since I reported my dad is that in Texas, survivors actually have many, many benefits. So for example, if a woman has, or if anyone has been abused as a child, or if you know, a woman's been raped or anything like that, you have access to counseling, you have access to housing allowance. I mean, there are many, many benefits that the state provides that I never dreamed of, and that really would have come in handy. And so, yes, always, always inform law enforcement, because there are many programs in existence to help and protect that survivor.
And I think, too, if I'm allowed to, I know we're taking your advice, so I don't mean to
interject. No, please.
You know, I think it's very important, too, to realize, get the civil magistrate involved, because they wield the sword for a purpose, right? They can coerce in certain ways that, as spiritual authorities in the church, as elders, as pastors, we can't, you know? And so, you know, when you get those two authorities working in tandem to deal with this, you really do get a more comprehensive response. And I think, yes, to help those who are victims, but also the civil magistrate just has things at their disposal that are able to also pursue justice against the abuser.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of just Christians in general too, you know, I've heard this beautiful desire, and it is a beautiful desire, but I'm afraid it's a naive desire. This idea that, oh, if there's a, you know, domestic violence going on, we can just, you know, we can put Sally over at this person's house, and we can put Bob over at this person's house, and we can separate them, and we can totally take care of this in-house. I don't think people realize how dangerous that is. Mm-hmm. Because if you have an abuser who is so warped that they're willing to molest their own child or beat up their own wife, think about their capacity for evil at that point. Mm-hmm. It is incredible,
and how deceptive they are. deceptive.
Exactly. Yes. They're very deceptive. They're very dangerous. Someone who's willing to do that to their own child is capable of pretty much anything. Mm-hmm. So you really want to have law enforcement involved.
Mm-hmm. Well, and of course, another story that's come out in these recent year or two is Rachel Den Hollander's story. Yeah. And she would be agreeing, I think, wholeheartedly with what you're saying, with just the need to tell authorities.
She's a sweetheart. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, it's been incredible.
I love Rachel.
The one thing I can interject here and just concur with you, Jennifer, and just really assert for any elders or pastors out there, it is not betraying your office to go to law enforcement. And to echo what Kyle said, the idea is to work in tandem with law enforcement. The church and the state should not be opposed when it comes to victims. And it should not be that the church is trying to protect the perpetrator and get him forgiveness.
Yeah.
And the state just wants to hammer him. No, I think we have to work in tandem. It's essential that we do.
Well, one of the things that I think a lot of people don't understand, or at least a misunderstanding that I've encountered in the church, when you report someone, you're actually doing the loving thing. Mm-hmm. You are holding them accountable for their sin. You are ensuring that they're held accountable by the law. For example, if I were to, report an abuser and I was able to get a restraining order against them, you know, some people would say, oh, well, why didn't you just forgive them? Or, you could have gotten them into big trouble. No, that holds them accountable for their evil. Mm-hmm. And it actually potentially prevents them from further damaging their soul as they continue in their sin. Mm-hmm. Because now, if they're afraid to go on abusing, maybe they'll stop and maybe they won't sink themselves further into hell. I mean, really, I came to a place where I knew that my dad wasn't saved, and I was given the choice between calling the police on him or letting him continue to abuse my little sisters.
Yes.
That was the choice.
It's incredible that most people in the church, if someone stole their car, and they would readily know they should involve the civil authorities. But when someone steals something much more valuable than a car, which is taking from a child their innocency, for some reason we get all mixed up. And the church really needs a lot of help. And I think this piece of advice is key and crucial and can't be emphasized enough, involving civil authorities when a crime like this has been committed. But there's also the need for the church to help shepherd in the situation, because that victim is going to need support. And so again, talking to us as elders in the church, what are some other ways that you would encourage us to help help leaders in the church or the church itself to help and support those who've been victimized?
Well, one thing, I always like to encourage church leaders to create a network for the survivor. Referring the survivor to a therapist or a counselor or a lawyer, it doesn't mean you're passing them off, right? Mm-hmm. Because they still need your spiritual pastoral care. And so one of the things that I found really helpful was having a pastor who could help me with my spiritual needs, and at the same time a counselor who could help me with more medical or psychological needs. But when those people work in tandem with each other, because that way, say for example, I need to go to a therapist who is specialized in complex PTSD. Well, what if I can't find a Christian therapist? So I end up going to a secular therapist. They're a good, they're a doctor. They can meet that need that I have, but some of their advice may be secular. And so I can take their advice and I can bring it over here to my pastor and I can say, hey, my therapist said this, this, and that. What do you think of that? And so I can kind of bounce their advice off of you, the pastor, but then also vice versa. If my pastor says something weird, like I once had a pastor say, well, you really should forgive your dad and just let go of your anger, I can take that to my therapist and I can say, hey, you know, I know this sounds biblical and I know this sounds right, but how does this look? How do I do this? What practical steps can I take to process my anger? Because obviously, you know, we don't want to just shove our anger down and pretend we're happy when we're not. The Bible is, you know, is not in favor of lying or faking or hypocrisy. But having that network, and the other thing that is good about having a network of law enforcement, pastors, counselors, physicians, friends, is that you're never going to be able to be there 24/7 for a survivor. You just physically can't. You're one human being. You know, there's going to be times when that survivor may become suicidal. And what happens if they can't reach you on the phone? Or what happens if, for whatever reason, they're scared to call their pastor and they'd rather call a doctor? Or, you know, whatever the case may be. And so you really just want to surround them. It's like there's a proverb that says, with many counselors is strength, or with many counselors a nation is secure. And I really think this is a prime example of that. You need many counselors. Mm-hmm.
I know when we've had those in our congregation who've struggled, I always felt it was very important, especially for women, to have other women involved with them. And again, it can be an awkward thing. It can be a hard thing. But I know when they've come in for counseling with myself or some of the elders, to just have another woman's presence that they can leave the meeting and have interactions with. And like you did with you mentioned with the therapist, reflecting on things, the counsel you've heard, to just figure out how to work that out in a more
absolutely
way.
And you know, you also want the survivor to be able to come back to church.
Yes.
If they've told you embarrassing, humiliating, dehumanizing details about their sexual abuse, they may never feel secure or comfortable again watching you preach on Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. And so they need that outlet. They need to be able to compartmentalize who they talk to about what.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the other things that we need to really stress in all of this as well is that we don't have the power of the sword in the church, but we do have church discipline. And I think that has to really be a part of this whole package deal as well. If the abuse has happened in the church and the abuser's in the church, then the elders of the church really need to deal with this.
Absolutely.
But strongly, so that he's held accountable, not only in the civil realm, but also in the ecclesiastical one.
And there's so many reasons for that. It's not just to reprimand the abuser or to call them to repent. You're actually sending a very strong message to other people in your church when you do that. Mm-hmm. So say, for example, you've got other people either in your congregation or even in the surrounding community who are watching your church, and they see that, oh wow, someone was disciplined in this church for domestic violence or sexual assault or whatever it may be. What that tells to survivors and good Christian people is that this church is a safe place. If someone hurts my kids or if someone hurts me, the church is going to do something about it. It's a safe place. And also, what that tells abusers is that this church is not a safe place for me. Because if I go to this church and I hurt that child in Sunday school, or, you know, I beat my wife or whatever, and this church finds out, they're going to discipline me. And I don't want that, so I'm going to stay away. Mm-hmm. And that is absolutely a message you want to send.
Amen. And I even think, you know, in the idea of wielding the keys of the kingdom, you know, this is where my heart is, to see pastors and elders willing to wield those in very difficult ways. You know, I'm so tired of the stories of telling abuse victims, you know, well, did you follow Matthew 18? Well, you know, let's take a breath here and realize that we can stand in the place and help defend those who are oppressed and those who are innocent. And I get that the Bible has principles of justice that want to balance both for the accused and for the accuser. And that's where come on, pastors, wield these keys with all their difficulty. Yeah, you're going to have to ask awkward questions, and you're going to need to be very forceful with those whom accusations are being brought against, and to take that seriously. But I also just think, you know, Jennifer, one of the things that I just appreciate about your story and the way that you're able to relate it is, I think the patience that needs to be shown to victims. You know, if people have been gaslighted and they've been shut down and disbelieved since 5 years old, you know, of course, some of the way in which we want, you know, to cross all of our T's and dot all of our I's, it's not ideal. And we need to be patient, and we need to come alongside of. And you know, when helpless and weak people can't stand for themselves, that's where you need pastors and elders to say, but we will, you know, we
absolutely
do that difficult work. And so that's my
absolutely.
Two.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. You just reminded me when you were talking, I had this, a woman come to me privately and tell me this story about how her husband had beaten her up, and her pastor, and I don't remember what denomination this was in, but her pastor told her, well, you need to, you know, Matthew 18, you need to go and talk to your husband and tell him what he's done wrong. And I was like, excuse me? When he was hitting you, you told him to stop, right? You begged him to stop, right? So you just Matthew 18 it up. You already did that.
Yes,
it is. That's right. It's now time for those pastors to get out of their libraries and their studies and go and talk to your husband. And it's time for them to involve the authorities.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, because, you know, and even in Texas now, I'm not a legal expert like Rachel Den Hollander is, but just from an ethical standpoint, from a moral standpoint, even if you're not dealing with child abuse or sexual abuse, if you're dealing with domestic violence, like, for example, when my dad threw an iron at my head, or when he threw me down the stairs, or when he even there was a situation a couple times when he just got mad at me. And so we were driving in the car and he was weaving recklessly in and out of traffic. And I thought we were going to die. Hmm. Those types of things actually endanger someone's life. You know, I consider those, I mean, arguably throwing an iron at my head could have been attempted murder. Weaving in and out of traffic. There were a couple times when he threatened to shoot me. Those were all, those were crimes. And those are situations where law enforcement need to be involved because, you know, thank God I survived my childhood, but quite likely I might not have. Mm-hmm. You know, there's been many times when I've met with pastors or just friends and I've talked over different stories and they've looked at me and they said, Jennifer, it's amazing you even made it to 18. And I've had to say, I know. You know, because as a kid, I didn't expect to.
Well, those are words that really, in a sense, are ending with a plea for the church to listen to those who are hurting in their midst and to step up and to take the proper action, as we've heard today. Jennifer, we do want to thank you again for joining us and for being open and honest and forthright. It's been Thanks. Very instructive to us.
And I'm sorry, it kind of closed on a dark note there.
No, that's okay. This is a heavy subject, and it's okay to end with a little bit of a reminder of the pain and the difficulty that you've gone through. I want to encourage our listeners, if you want to find out more about Jennifer, she does have a website. It's jennifergreenberg.net, and we'll put that in our show notes, but you can see more about her book. She writes articles. She even produces some music that you might enjoy listening to. So head on over there and find out more about Jennifer. And thank you once again for joining us here on 3GT. If you not only want to find out more about Jennifer, but about us, you can go over, it's not as exciting, but you can go over to 3GT.xyz where you'll see our other episodes and find out ways that you can spread the news and encourage this particular podcast. Thanks for listening once again to 3GT.